So Matthew Tinoco, thank you very much for joining us for the 76th episode of JT the LA Storyteller Podcast. It is such a pleasure to meet and greet a fellow storyteller in the city, and I'm really looking forward to our discussion today because we both care about LA and are also fascinated by LA, and we also are of the mind that we need to really tell particular stories about the city so as to inform more of our neighbors, more of our neighborhoods and communities. And so it's great to have you on the show. How goes it?
I'm very honored to be here. Thank you, JT. It goes well in the year of our Lord 2021, but no, I'm just excited to get into it and see where this conversation takes us.
Absolutely. And so what I want to do is allow you the opportunity to introduce yourself to the Los Cuentos listenership out there. Please tell us about Matthew Tinoco and where we're at now, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. So let's fit myself into the LA story here, right? I think I like to refer to myself as the, depending on how you slice it, the third or fourth generation of my family to sit in traffic in the Cahuenga Pass. That's the specific hook that I'll use because I grew up in the northwest quadrant of the Southern California metroplex. So I was born in downtown or at Good Samaritan Hospital, but my family at the time lived in Palmdale. And then I went to elementary school in Simi Valley. And then once my grandfather passed, one of those generations who drove through the Cahuenga Pass, we inherited his house in North Hollywood, which was also always my grandfather's house when I was growing up. So it was a house, I'm very familiar with that area and consider North Hollywood my home. That's just kind of the little broad strokes biography there. But I'm a mixed race Angeleno, like many people are. My mom is a white lady from the San Fernando Valley. My dad is he was born here. He's of Mexican descent from also the San Fernando Valley. And they both grew up in the North Hollywood Burbank area. My dad grew up in Mexico, actually. He was born here, but he went to elementary school in Mexico and then came back I think around sixth grade into Burbank public schools, where he was one of the first Latino kids in Burbank public schools or one of the only ones at the time. And they met through mutual friends. My dad was an Army Ranger. My mom was a teacher. And then after my dad had an Army friend who they met, I believe they actually met in Santa Clarita. I think that's where their mutual friend lived. And my mom taught in that area at the time. And my dad at the time worked for Ralph's. And I don't actually, I can't tell you all the details, but I was born a couple of years later. And I have a younger brother too, Nick. And yeah, it's just, so my mom's family, I don't really only know my mom's father. He's the only grandparent who who I actually really talked with. My father's parents, his father passed when I was a kid, very young. I think I was two or three. And then his mother moved back to Mexico after that happened. So I really only ever exchanged a couple words with her. My house is shaking from some helicopter.
Wow, that's harsh.
It's a pretty substantial one to do. It's got to be one of those military ones.
I think it just came across this side too. I'm hearing it coming over towards this side now. Yeah, it's just, the buzz is just over ours now. Yeah. But we're downstairs, so.
Sorry, I don't know. I'm just chattering along here. But he was my mom's father, who was born in Scotland. He was a white man who was born in Scotland. He was a studio worker. So he worked he served in the Royal British Army in World War II, and then he came back here. And then he was an American. I don't know when he got his American citizenship, but he immigrated from Scotland when he was young, when it was 1920. And then he worked in studios his whole life. My mom's mom was a nurse at almost always at County General Hospital. And then on my father's side, his father was a cook at the Smokehouse and other restaurants in, this is the restaurant on Pass in Burbank, just across from Warner Brothers. And all of this has led to me being here, a reporter in Los Angeles now. Here I am. That's all I can say. I'm now a podcast guy. That's where it's led. I have a podcast now, which is I guess where all things end up inevitably. But yeah. So
yeah, and we'll absolutely get there. We'll absolutely get to that before long. But actually, as you describe this story of your family's time in the city, what I realize is that, you know, especially the intermingling of, say, Mexican American or Latinx people and the predominantly white populations in LA over the course of the decades, that's something that you can explore across the city on so many different scales. But what I sort of recall now is that, especially when it comes to the Valley, there's not a whole lot that I'm familiar with in terms of that Mexican American heritage in that part of town. And so it's sort of certainly now when you get out to, say, North Hollywood, and when you get out to Panorama City, when you get out to, say, that Northwest Side, as you pointed out, you see a whole lot of that Latinx culture. But what I realize is, oh, we don't have as many stories about Mexican Americans on that side of town in the years of World War II and just afterwards. And yet they're there. There's like a significant portion of, say, that segregationist valley and the way that policies of segregation really walled off these white communities for some time. But there is, obviously, when it comes to stories such as yours and families such as yours, there are also these kind of subversive ways or just overlooked ways that Mexican American folks have really made a living in LA, including with, say, white or European immigrant families, because that's sort of what I think of them as. I don't think of, say, whites over the 1920s as white in the way we think of whiteness today. I sort of realize, oh, right, they were coming from everywhere, including Scotland and Germany and these various other places. So it's just a story that I think has been overlooked, actually, the way that there's been this blend over the course of much time, which leads to people in the city having these very interesting intersectional identities, actually.
Yeah, very. Yes, thank you for hearing that. I appreciate that, because it is, much gets said about like representation and non like hegemonic representation and whatever in the media and everything in the culture. And coming, I guess, from the Valley is strange. It's strange to come from the place that makes the images, I guess. And the Mexican and then the other like Hispanic diaspora, Spanish language diaspora, and not Spanish, indigenous language diaspora, into what is now the San Fernando Valley does largely get overlooked. And just generally, I think lends the valley to being a place that people don't really, like people, unless you've lived there for a very long time, you kind of just parachute in and out. And I think it's very difficult to get a sense of the place and like what's actually happened there. And I think kind of as I relate it back to my own family, like one of the things that I remember my mom saying to me was something like that, because my parents were both going through public schools in the San Fernando Valley right at the same point that busing was a topic of discussion. And I operate on the, like most, like for the most part that Los Angeles schools never really integrated, in that they just like busing was tried. A couple classes of students were bused around the city, but like the geographic scale of like, we're going to bus students from like South Los Angeles, what it would be called now, South Central, wherever, and to like the South San Fernando Valley. It's just also like distinctly like political stuff, which is like why it failed in by the mid 80s. It was also just geographically impractical. Like you're going to make kids sit on 90 minutes for a bus, like given to the way like Los Angeles's residential segregation is set up. It's just like geography segregates people so much so. I say that just because, like, as I think about how race in the San Fernando Valley works out, it is the place that we have right now, the Valley of today, is very much the Valley that was sort of coded in the late 70s and late 80s, which was already like the second iteration of the San Fernando Valley as a transition from first an agricultural community, or at least in like modern Los Angeles history, it was in the Valley of today is very much like the Valley of the 70s and 80s. That's kind of how it was made, right? Where it's like in the wake of immigration reform and then civil conflict in Central America, South America, and Mexico, like, I mean by this, if you talk to people who live in the San Fernando Valley, it's like white flight is still like something that may have just happened. Like, and that is, and like, we live in the world just after that. But like the vernacular hasn't really discussed, it hasn't caught up to the fact that by now that was maybe two or three generations ago. And now there's all of these just like kind of mixed race tan kids running around the valley, just like kind of feeling pretty lost where everywhere else.
What I also realize is I've got a book recommendation for you, which is Stephen Block's Going All City, which is basically a book about graffiti and this graffiti writer who has both these white as well as, say, Latinx roots, and whose upbringing is in the Valley of all places, and who basically describes this part of town as a really sort of very strange land of subversion, once again, in terms of identity, in terms of how young people might collectively identify in the face of a city that is invested in criminalizing youth of color. In particular, when you say the Valley, I think of the criminalization of graffiti, right? The bus stop movement of the late 70s and early 80s that you were describing earlier. I think of this homeowners range, if you will, where homeowners movements have really sort of very successfully opposed a transformation of the Valley to be a more comprehensive, more inclusive, more cohesive place to live in. And so I do think that you're right in that, oh, white flight has sort of just happened, but you still have this city, this suburban environment that functions as it sort of was supposed to function back in the 60s when a lot of this was first being erected. And so as one goes through the valley now, it's clear that, whoa, there's an old Los Angeles here to some extent. Like it's just there. You can feel it on every corner. Yep. And yet again, there's a lot of storytelling to do there. There's a whole lot that's actually been going on. It just hasn't quite been really uncovered at a substantial level yet.
No. And I think that's just, it is, I think there's an interesting question to ask about the politics of the city of Los Angeles right now. In particular, the makeup of this particular city council and the mayor, who for the large part grew up in the South San Fernando Valley. I think it's at once like both near and far from the center of power. Like the center of power in Los Angeles is obviously downtown and the West LA, but like at the same time, like the city council president represents the Northeast San Fernando Valley and wields politics very explicitly from a position as somebody who is from the Northeast San Fernando Valley. And like, it is at once forgotten, but also it's like none of this is like forgotten by who, right? Like it's just not cut and dry. And then it's also just like, it is like sort of suburban, but it's also not. It's like a wild, like there's, I mean, if you mentioned Panorama City earlier, if you're going around Panorama City, like, there is really profound pockets of really residential density in the San Fernando Valley, although it remains a pretty hostile place to work or walk. I'm sorry, excuse me. It is the infrastructure of the valley is one where you really do rely on a car. Otherwise, that metro bus will come maybe once every 45 minutes. And that's also, I think, right now, very current, a sort of product of that, like the people who didn't white flight are still holding on. And like, God forbid you put a bus lane on Nordoff so like CSUN students can get to college faster. Like that's like it. I think now I think about it, like the way the Valley works, and this is one of your future questions. Like obviously I cover housing and homelessness, but the way the experience of the San Fernando Valley is very much mediated by how you move through it, and specifically how you drive through it, where it is a place where if you, like, as much as people say like Los Angeles is a car city, like I actually don't think that's necessarily true in Central City, where you can for the most part get around pretty efficiently without using a personal vehicle, which then again, remember, using a personal vehicle, you're going to have a driver's license, and are like that it has a sort of carceral hook to it that the state can wield if it needs to. Not so true if you're just like getting on the Metro bus, and then I don't know, the South, but and the Valley is like knows that and goes out of their way to demonize public transportation because, oh well, that's where the unsheltered people come from. But like, I don't know,
Los Angeles. I mean, and it actually reminds me that in the early 2000s, especially as you mentioned, say that Northwest Valley side and its representation at the LA city level, I realized it was in the early 2000s that there was a secession vote for the Valley. So to just emphasize the way that there's like this hub there and this real sort of separation from the city of LA there, that has in fact been taken to the ballot box before, and that has sort of been a thing. Just the sense that, hey, you know what, the Valley is its own place, it's its own culture, therefore we should be able to decide politically for ourselves what policies we've got. That has been a thing, and of course we just got through a big, long, and really sort of uninspiring recall effort here in California, right? So it all interlinks the way that these sort of very right-wing politics and right-wing ways of looking at city making tend to go very far. That is politically coming down to policy that ends up reverberating for so long. So, okay, all that about the Valley, but I want to ask you, Matt, in terms of say like how this place and growing up on this side of town informed not just your sense of LA, but also your interest in LA. How do you go from the Valley to looking at the larger city and the city's history and the city's politics?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so Valley is where I'm from, right? And like Palmdale and Simi Valley, which we haven't talked about Simi Valley. It's this whole other place. It's kind of like San Fernando Valley plus in a way in terms of its attitudes. But for the more or less like since like 2012, I've lived in Metro LA. I think what you said earlier in terms of like my own like intersectional perspective of like both being Latino and white, but also not really being either. And that sort of allots me, it allots me a level of privilege that like, I want to do more research about like the, like being mixed race is very, very like, at the foremost, like it's at the front of my head most times of day as I'm moving through public space. Cause I never know how somebody's going to code me. It could be, and I know that this is the experience of like a lot of different people, but it really gets like often a lot of times people think I'm Asian or like I'm East Asian, and like, sure, maybe I could be half Filipino. Like it's what it just gets strange when like people who are like of East Asian descent or of Filipino descent are like talking to me as if I was Filipino. And I'm like, sure, I'm not actually Filipino though. Like, and then it's like, what I think it lets me do, at least in terms of like, as I talk to people as a reporter, is it means that I can start talking about race really fast in a way that I don't necessarily know it other people. Again, this is just my own experience. I don't know how quickly other people talk about race in their own private company. And in most of my like, not always, but a lot of the time, like the people's other people's, like, of all races. And like, it's not like just white, it's like people who are of a single ethnic identifier, sort of. That's not really a good way to do it, because I don't think anybody can, it's like, it's a very difficult to pin it down, right? But like, people's discomfort with, and this is like general, I think just like for the like Latinx experience, like it's something that everybody in this sort of like catch-all of like sort of people, I'll use the phrase like Raza, because I think it's almost just like, it's easier than just like trying to call everybody in, or at least using the words that we have right now to discuss this stuff. What I mean by that is that the like discomfort that people have in that they cannot immediately categorize it, to the point that so regularly people are just like I give my credit card to the cashier and they see Tinoco, that's a what name? It could be anything. They could say anything. What kind of name is that? Because it's a Spanish, Portuguese, Mexican name, but like people don't know it. And then like, I'm probably not going to have this whole conversation with the cashier, but like, it happens all the time in my just general personal life and professional life where people are asking me about that. And then that more or less gives me space to start immediately. So tell me more about your like views on your sort of racial identity and how that informs you going through your world very fast, which that's not exactly what you asked me, but like in terms of moving through the like multiracial space of Los Angeles, the fact that there is never a space where I feel particularly at home in sort of gives me like I feel a little bit of like privilege and fluidity to like kind of just pass through, which it is at once kind of alienating, but also like, I don't know. It just lets me kind of like, in terms of like how I do reporting, like it's very much at the front of my mind all the time. And like, I can't not see it. You can't not see how this stuff works in Los Angeles, because the way this place racializes space is just, it's just wild. And how it just continues, even among like the good liberals who are like probably not consciously doing this, but like the like unconscious reproduction of racism in Los Angeles is just, I believe the co-host Scott Frazier on the LA podcast, or LA podcast, it's not the LA podcast, excuse me. That's my problem. I think Scott called it a like monument to white supremacy, which like it is. But that's sort of, I think a lot about racialized space in Los Angeles, and that's a very current thing. And like, you see it, like the production of white gentrification space in, like what you said earlier about the San Fernando Valley, where it's like, it does feel kind of like old LA. It is old LA. And I think to a large extent, the uncoolness of the Valley versus the relative coolness of like Silver Lake or Echo Park or Highland Park is sort of shielding it from that, like that profit mechanism that is very interested in trying to get rich off of the production of white space in like brown spaces, whether that's East Hollywood or Virgil Village or wherever. Like there is absolutely gentrification in the Valley, like it is in Metro. And there absolutely is a tremendous, like housing insecurity and gentrification are like kind of separate things. One of them can drive another thing. Gentrification can totally create more housing insecurity for people in that particular area. But like, I think just like at once, and then at the same time, like the South San Fernando Valley is like the apogee of like the Western civilization's ability to produce white space. Like Ventura Boulevard is like at once a like profoundly multiracial ethnic place, but like also a definitively white space in the city of Los Angeles. And I don't know, that's just, this is what I think about as I drive around LA or take the bus or take the red line. I love the red line. Oh, it's not that, it's the B line now, whatever it is.
It is still the red line. It is still the red line. And I realize, oh, well, what's also true is that you went to school at USC,
yeah,
which is located at this other fascinating intersection for the city of Los Angeles, at this other historic environment full of tensions for Los Angeles. And therefore, your ability to, say, pass through has sort of allowed you to really pursue this interest about racialized space and racialized housing conditions that disproportionately affect Black and Latinx and trans and queer folks in the city. And I think I saw just the other day that 75% of the land in the U.S. Is mostly set up for single family homeowning. And that's just absurd when you sort of think about how much land that is and how much land has been defined on these very racialized terms. And when you recall that, oh, LA has been an innovator, it's been a hub for the single family home as white space, then you realize, oh, it's really tied to where the nation is headed, where the state of the states are headed, so to speak. So I think all of these things come together in a way to make you interested in, yeah, how we arrived here, which is perfect for a storyteller, actually.
It's funny. I will refer to, I remember writing a job application to be a reporter covering the suburbs of America. And I said I was from the San Fernando Valley. And like the multi-ethnic flatlands of Los Angeles County, that I used the phrase the sort of urtext of American suburbia, and like it is because watch a national election coverage and you have like the talking heads go, well, the suburbs and whatever, blah 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 blah. It's like most of America is a suburban environment. Like it's Riverside, it's Glendale, Arizona, it's like Simi Valley, California is a place that was engineered out of white supremacy to keep dark-skinned people away. And at this very moment, Simi Valley, California retains that cultural characteristic, but is also 40% non-Anglo. And like at this, and it's a very, and like, this is something, I mean, I haven't done that. Like I went to elementary school in Simi Valley. That's where we rented houses. We moved around in Simi Valley several times. And it was, I think back to like my elementary school classroom, and it's like very much what's in vogue talking about right now, where it's like, there are the white kids and then the non-white kids are like, it's about the same number of them. And oh, what does this say about America? It doesn't say anything about America. It's just what's happening. Like, and like America's not going to change because like 52% of America is non-Anglo or is non like Euro-American. But like, it's just, I don't know. That's just something else that kind of sits on my mind here. But like, yeah, so you might have to repeat your question here, but this is what I gave you in response.
No, you're fine. You're fine. We're on the right track here. What I want to ask you about next, Matt, is really how you sort of came to look at especially homelessness in the city of LA. This is something that your work is well known for. And so I'm interested in how this came about, maybe even when did you start reporting on, say, these housing conditions in the city, these racialized housing conditions in the city, and what sort of really drove you to do the kind of reporting work that you would become known for across LA's various media outlets?
So when I was in the questions that you gave to me before this, you more or less asked me how I became a journalist, and I don't have a good answer. There was never a moment where I was like, yes, this is what I want to do. It was kind of like I was always doing it. So I wrote for my high school newspaper, and then I wrote for the USC College publications. And then, but also while I was in college, I realized somebody told me to do it. Like I could also pitch other publications that would pay me for the work. And that's effectively what I started doing. And I remember one of the very first, I remember two things. I remember an article that one of my journalism teachers showed me, and like he showed the class. I wasn't a journalism major, but I was briefly for a period of time. And I did take a couple classes. And my teacher, Alan Mittelstadt, like he gave us all an article that was, I think it was a Vice article that was more or less saying, look at all the stuff the LA Times missed in their coverage of a police shooting at the encampment, then underneath the 10 freeway at Venice on Venice Boulevard. And And it just went to town at, like, the LA Times effectively published the police press release of the situation. And the other article, I think it was in Vice, just pulled the whole thing apart. And, like, very, very clearly demonstrated how poorly the institutional media covered what we see everywhere, increasingly so now than in 2013, when that was, that I read that article.
I'd really like the link to that article, by the way, just to be sure. Yeah.
But the it might not have been specifically about the LA Times too. It could have been my teacher was drawing that comparison. In any case, it was a story that documented a police shooting underneath the Venice Boulevard 10 freeway overpass. And then I think maybe my teacher compared it to the LA Times' press release version of the story. In any case, what I remember is that not long after, maybe like a year after that, I remember pitching an article about the it was the police shooting of he was always identified to me as Cameroon when I went to Skid Row. There was a mentally ill gentleman who was shot and killed by LAPD right outside of the Union Rescue Mission on San Pedro Street. And I went to Skid Row and just started talking to people there. And like, that was one of the first stories that I really covered by just talking to people who were there. And like, that, I don't know if that was the first time I was talking to people on Skid Row. I don't think it was, but like, that was probably like one of the first things I did. And it was so obviously wrong. It's like, this gentleman was having, like, he was severely mentally ill, and then the police responding shot and killed him. And like, because they were not equipped to deal with it because of so many different reasons. And this is the gentleman who, I believe his name is, his first name is Charlie, but he was always also referred to as Africa in local press. So even now it's like, rest in peace, Africa. Though nobody ever called him Africa when I was out reporting. I'm very curious to know where that name came from, because everybody I spoke with in that particular area on that particular block, like the day after the shooting and the day of the shooting, if I remember correctly, they called him Cameroon. And he was a Cameroonian national. In any case, that's a different discussion. But after that, I don't know. It comes down to just, once you start talking to people outside, like, and you hear what's happened, it's like, how do people still, how does our like media system continue punching down on people who have nothing, on the poorest people in America? And that makes me angry. And that's effectively kind of why I've continued to do it, because there's such a great need, especially because this isn't getting better. And like, the public discussion is deteriorating on this particular issue at this point, which is like not what I was thinking about in 2015. I think more recently, like in July of 2018, I started working as Southern California Public Radio, KPCC FM's housing reporter. I was hired as the housing reporter, and I started doing some housing stories, but very, very quickly it became mostly stories covering unsheltered homelessness. One, because that's what my inbox is filled with. People are always like, it is the most urgent issue in Los Angeles, and it's covered so poorly by most media in Los Angeles. And so when I was at KPCC, I was like, okay, well, KPCC has a huge platform. May as well do my best to try and get some like antidote coverage out here that just like humanizes people outside. Because like, for the most part, people living outside just get dehumanized by like everything. And that's kind of why I continue to do it, I guess, now, just because it is also like, I view it as just a taste of what's going to come. As the 21st century progresses, I'm very much of the thought that the tent camp is going to just be more. And it's not because of homelessness and drugs and mental illness and housing insecurity and like all of these other things. Like, it's all of this at once. But like, the end result is that a person, a human being, cannot actually secure an actual housing unit in wherever they are currently living. so that they either go somewhere else to try and do it, in the case of international migrants, unsuccessfully, because the United States is going to force them to stay at the border, and Mexico's not equipped to do this. Like, you see how, like, Los Angeles, like one of the world's richest cities, is not doing this, not doing it, is not able to house people in any meaningful way, or in some meaningful way, but like at the scale needed. And that's also kind of very at the front of mind as I'm doing this. When I'm talking to people who are living in RVs, it's very much like, you're just kind of on the very edge of this whole thing that's just going to accelerate going forward, right? Like, I think I worry quite a lot about where we are at this exact moment in 2021, which is different from where it was in like 2018 or 2019,
right,
where there's the impulse to criminalize, because it's not going to work. Unless, like, it's not going to work, but it's also like, when that is happening right now, is that setting the foundation for a United States that just I think I know what the answer is, right? But it's like 10 or 15 years down the line, like, our climate migration crisis has like really begun to happen in earnest. And what happens then? Like, I don't know.
Well, I think really the last year and a half has been so demonstrative, right? In that we, especially at the outset of what was supposed to be the greatest sort of health crisis in over a century, during which we would prioritize sheltering, not even entirely housing, but sheltering our most vulnerable. We've seen that over the last year and a half, we really sort of have swung the pendulum in the other direction, right? From this political sense that our most vulnerable should be somehow accounted for, that the red tape should be cut through for them because it is the humane thing to do. We really have gone from that sort of at least ostensible sentiment to just further belittling and reducing space for the most vulnerable in our communities, as we have to make up for policies we've failed to bring to fruition. That is to say, with things like Project Room Key, with all of Los's tenure in general, with LA's sheltering system, even pre-pandemic, if you will, right? So we're really sort of accounting for the failures of these various institutions given this unprecedented health crisis, right? And so it's fascinating to think about that and how quickly the political winds may change. And of course, again, as we noted just a little earlier, we've gotten through this recall, at least the state has, so to speak. But Newsom really only has a year, actually, before it's time for the official revisiting of his tenure for the highest political office in the state. And so it's curious, because the priorities going forward are something that I think absolutely mean very much to the city of LA. And yet I don't know that this recall election has been this kind of epiphanous moment for the city or the city's political minds, in that, hey, like, if we're going to do something regarding climate crisis in the 21st century, and LA's place in that, and the city of California's place in that, then it's high time. And here again, we've got another opportunity to really remake the state in a more humane fashion for the challenges and crises ahead, of which there are many, right? And so I think it's interesting, but Newsom has just signed a couple of bills, though not all, pertaining to housing. And I'm curious about your thoughts, maybe in passing, about some of the various bills signed by the governor's office just after surviving the recall effort. What do you think this sort of says about where LA may be headed over the next year? Because it's not just Newsom that's up for an election in 1 year, but the city of Los Angeles in just a handful of months is also going through this tumultuous political season right here at home. So where do you think we are just within the next year and a half for our city and our state, actually?
I really don't know. Newsom, when other people around me were very confident that Newsom wasn't going to be recalled, and I was much less confident because I just don't ever, I'm speaking to like the California State Democratic Party.
I don't think it's just, I think it's very vulnerable to something like what happened to Hillary Clinton, right? And just because there's fewer Republicans, it doesn't necessarily mean there's more Democrats, if that makes sense. At least when I think about like how, like who the median Californian is a 28-year-old Latina in Bakersfield or something like that, right? Like, not speaking for her, but like chances are she's not IDing super hard as like a Democrat. Or really want to make sure that going to contribute to the DCCC or whatever. To the point that I think our politics in California and LA I don't know if the language has caught up to where it is right now, or if there's stuff that keeps the language from getting there just because the status quo of Gavin Newsom and the state Dems just kind of putting the coin into the machine and it gives a result. Which I think is how it is right now, but it just leaves so many people out of the process. I mean, I can't get over that 1 in 10 people in LA County, they don't have their papers, right? An undocumented immigrant. That's 1/10 of LA County that is never going to get to, like, you can't vote, like where there's been non-existent interest.
A million people,
right? Like, and that's in a county that has like 5 elected supervisors sitting at the top who wield more power, like they represent more people than like senators, right? How many senators represent 2 million? I mean, I don't, that's a different math situation. But I mean, I don't really frame myself, I'll get to SB 9 and 10, I promise. But I don't, in terms of how I think about politics, it's not partisan because I don't think, like, again, as my job as a reporter, I'm supposed to talk up, I roll up to whoever and I want to engage you in a very long conversation to try and figure out what you actually think about this thing and why. And in that why and what you think thing, it's always so much more complicated than the public narratives make, than the political talking points are. And so I just, when I look at like the existing political system, I see something that like the existing political discourse in the state of California, like let's talk about housing, right? Okay, so housing, we have SB 9 and SB 10. Cool, it seems like we can do fourplexes most places in the state of California. Sure, fine, I that's cool, I guess. Do I, a RSO tenant in the city of Los Angeles, have the material resources to benefit from that and cut apart my single family property and turn it into a fourplex? No, I don't. I'm not a property owner. And I think a lot of people aren't. So I think it's pretty far away from them. Would I live on one? Sure. But also, like, you have to, with that stuff, it is a fact that like our housing situation is completely fucked. And like, it is a material benefit that you can now build 4 units of housing on a single family lot than not. Assuming it makes, like, we'll see, if it happens, right? Like, I'll believe it when I see it, because like this state is very, like what I was getting to is that our discussion on so many things, but particularly housing, is between like NIMBY homeowners and commercial developers. And that's what controls the state's housing discourse, with like a couple other people here and there thrown out, like the YIMBY movement, which I earnestly do think is much more, I think the talking points from the YIMBY like organized movement is going to be much more close to that commercial developer perspective than like a tenant who's like paying 80 or 90% of their income to live in the dilapidated housing stock that they live in because their landlord is an LLC with a like address in Boca Raton, Florida or something. And when it comes back to sort of how I think about California politics and Los Angeles politics and everything in this particular state, is that it's not so much about the actual, I guess, policies or like the political ideology of stuff, as it is so much just who's getting to actually be heard on this issue. because so like the vast majority of people who live in LA are not tuning into a city council meeting. They're not, we're so far away from our government. Like and our government does not work for anybody. It doesn't work for anybody who doesn't have the ability to peddle influence. And that's why I think when it goes to like why I work as a reporter is I think it's just like, I can't fix this right on my own, but like at the very best, maybe I can help some people be heard sometimes in some locations on some specific issues in some forum. And maybe it makes it to the politicos at some point, but like, I don't really think they're listening to me. And I guess that's just it. It's just because there's so many people who live here who are just completely written out of any formal process. Not like legally, like for the most part, our legal rights situation in the state of California is actually pretty considerable, but it's just because like who the fuck has time to like fill out this written complaint when you're sitting on the freeway for 5 hours a day trying to like keep your kid's house to like keep rent the 3-bedroom house in Palmdale so your kids can go to school and don't have to change schools, because if you're going to leave Palmdale, you're going to Bakersfield or Vegas, and like you're also worried about like doing like paying for that move. Like that's not like that person who I think is much more reflective of who actually lives in the place that we live is not being heard anywhere and doesn't and practically just doesn't have time to weigh in. Like not it's not a fault of their own. Like I cover homelessness, right? The amount of time somebody who has been homeless is like heard in a procedural meeting or like by the LASA commission or whatever is just it doesn't happen. Like, or if somebody calls in, like if an unsheltered person calls into city council, it's like a very moving moment, but it's like, okay, speaker, your time's up. That's it. And never nothing. And that's that. On those rare instances when somebody who is unsheltered actually not rare instances, it does happen quite a bit, but like, it's not officially acknowledged in any way. And I think that's all kind of, I think you get my point here.
Well, it actually does speak to what I'm very passionate about as a storyteller myself, and what I really see so much potential in, say, the podcasting scene for, certainly at the LA podcast just as well. You mentioned, say, like the actual representation of what California may be or what LA may be. And to me, while we can only sort of reach, say, an approximation of what LA actually is and who LA actually is, and likewise for the state, it's still nevertheless so rewarding to at the very least try and get these people and places seen or heard somehow, if not by our political officials, then by other people like them, other people in LA who can relate to experiences of being excluded by omission or being given 2 minutes for public comment at the city's budgetary decision-making meetings, right? And so that's sort of what really excites me about the LA podcast, which has been your latest medium. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about LA Podcast's unique position in the LA media landscape right now for stories such as what we've discussed now and for the various voices that actually make up the city and may in fact be able to engage with the city in a way that is more comprehensive and more reflective of who we actually just may be out here.
Yeah. So for LA Podcast, I am a recent addition to the LA podcast world. I've known the three people who made it occur, Scott Frazier, Alyssa Walker, and Hayes Davenport, for a fair amount of time. But more or less, I left KPCC now about a year ago. And then in the past couple of months, I've been working more or less full time at this point, trying to conceive of how can we get this little podcast that has some thousands of listeners and a very like highly engaged listener base and take it from where it is and like work in the LA's alternative media ecosystem is non-existent. It's just not. I used to write for Curbed. It doesn't exist anymore. or like for Los Angeles, I used to write for LAist. It's been absorbed into KPCC, which I've already discussed my issues there. The LA Weekly was bought by like an Orange County weed guy and like just right wing whatever. There's no medium in the city or county of, or I can't say it's none as there are, but there's very little by way of alternative media in, again, the second, like New York media. I mean, New York has so much media in it. And I think you can absolutely make the argument that New York media also just misses stuff going on. Like, when was the last time the New York Times visited like the Bronx? It hasn't happened. The goal of LA Podcast is to try and become that sort of alternative media voice and really become a sort of authority for those of us who read something in like if I turn on Channel 7, right? Like I watch a 30-minute newscast, I leave it feeling kind of empty, like I didn't actually learn anything, right? But obviously there's so many urgent things going on right now that are direly important, that are literally a matter of life and death for so many people. And it's just not heard anywhere in other media. And so maybe this little like show that has an engaged listener base and a like good rate of people who contribute to it, who like seem invested and are actually showing others that like, hey, this is something that I feel good about contributing to, maybe we can make that into something much bigger, which is what I'm trying to do. And it's very hard. I'm a reporter. I'm not like I'm not a manager. I don't know how to do business stuff. Like I'm learning all of this very quickly. And I promised anybody listening who would be interested in supporting us that I hear you and I'm going to do my very best here. But it's just, I don't know. I haven't made a new publication before, and I'm very happy to be working with Alyssa and Scott. Hayes has joined Councilmember Rahman's office formally, which was a split because it's again. That's also a point where it's like the proximity to the legislative power is something that is a distinction from at least where my role is, which is trying to. I'm not politically motivated. Like none of what I do is for a political end. That's not to say that I don't have takes or opinions about things and politics in the city, but like at the end of the day, my obligation is to the readers and like to the people who are trying to consume this media. And everything I do is to try and like help better inform people to make better decisions or just know like better decisions at like the ballot box or like wherever, like just to know more about their city. And that's, I don't know, that's kind of the goal. It's just because I think the inciting incident was when, if you remember, the Citizen app had like they put up a reward for a guy. They falsely accused a man of starting a fire in the Pacific Palisades. They blasted his image to 900,000 people's phones all over Southern California and said, here's a 30,000 reward, go get them. And like, that's how lynch mobs happened, right? Like in American history, like the way lynching happened in the United States was somebody is falsely accused of a crime. They are held. The local publication says, hey, read this scandalous allegation that was made up, but like, we're going to print it anyway. And by the way, this person is here at this location. And yeah. And then like, that was the modes by which lynch mobs occurred in the United States. Media has not really reckoned with that. I don't know if like the American mainstream media, even like for the most part knows that history. But like when I saw the Citizen thing happen, I was like, oh shit, this is like, if we're at the point where we're going to have like tech platforms enabling lynch mobs, which is something that does happen, right? Not just in the United States, but everywhere, but like vigilantism, something that is really deep in Southern California's DNA, is if that's like where we are right now, well, maybe the little podcast can help. I like this is where I start feeling stupid, right? Like, what can I do to correct this? But I got to do something. So it's just like, I don't know if our, like, we need, like, it comes down to like, this, just, there's so much bad information out there. People know that's what they're getting and they want good information. And maybe I can be a source of good information. And maybe I can also do that with Alyssa Walker and Scott Fraser on the LA podcast and LA podcast. And we have a newsletter now on Saturday too, that you can also subscribe to and read. Subscribe to it, thelapod.com/newsletter. It'll come in your inbox on Saturday morning.
So Matt, we've had a really fruitful discussion and there are even more questions that I'd like to ask you, but we'll have to save those for a later time. For now, tell us about new members September at the LA Pod and how folks can engage with Discord and other folks who really care about this town and the issues that drive it, so to speak.
For the Discord, that's, I can't exactly say how to engage with it, but the Discord is going to be available for people who are, as we call, Sepulveda pass holders, which is another fancy way of saying people who subscribe on Patreon, which is the website that LA Podcast is with, for where you can make a monetary contribution, a monthly or yearly contribution. For new members September, it's just... basically, where the way LA Podcast is going to grow is if more people give us a little bit of money every single month, or you could do it as an annual contribution. It's better for you to do that. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/LA Podcast. That's where you can become a subscriber, right? Become a sustaining donor and really show that you want to be a part of whatever it is wherever we're going, right? I can't exactly say, as much as I want to say where we are going, like I can tease that we have some really good reporting coming out that's going to be very important, and I'm very excited to share it in due time. In due time being like in the next couple weeks here. But it's just, if you want to help us, the best way you can do that is by giving us a little contribution. That makes it us more able to cover expenses and really start reaching out there to do a lot of original work.
That is right. And I definitely want to co-sign Matt's call to more listeners out there to support the show. It is an absolutely worthy listen. And we are in Los Angeles. We are in traffic. We've got a whole lot of commuting to do. It is an excellent podcast to listen to while you make your way to work and from it. So I definitely want to co-sign this call and state my support for the LA Podcast and where it goes next. And Matt, I want to thank you for your time speaking with me today on JT the LA Storyteller Podcast. That has been so much fun, and all this time has passed, and now we've got to continue forward because there's just more to do, actually.
Literally endless. It will never stop, just like Los Angeles itself, you know?